And welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 9. Before we begin, of course, we openly acknowledge that we live and work in Shkrepmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Shkrepmak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory for our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now today, we once again are welcoming back a guest whose work is directly focused on bringing us humans back into a better relationship with the planet around us. Kelly Westgate is the owner of Lekker Land Design, a company that brings the important concept of permaculture to bear on developing what can be broadly called sustainable earth care projects. We're going to talk about the why, the where, the how, and the what of these projects. So welcome once again, Kelly, to Food Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me, Warren. It's great to be back.
Yes, well, I looked it up. It was 2021. It was 3 years ago, actually 3.5 years ago, that you were last on the show. And it was sort of in the world of the pandemic. It was sort of always, you know, in our face at that point. Did that have an effect on your business, the pandemic? Did it change?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
What happened?
It's so layered, like so many people, you know. It's some of the projects that I had, we you know, contacting people virtually for a change. So everybody getting shifted onto those online systems, learning how to use Zoom and, you know, how
to meet
themselves.
We got pretty good at it now.
look at us. And then things like, you know, some of the projects I had had volunteers involved, and sometimes there were, you know, people that got sick with COVID and, you know, had planned to come and volunteer but couldn't make it. So things were, of course, changing all the time. There was a lot of on-the-fly adaptation. Those of us that, you know, were there to do sort of an installation project or what have you, you ended up working a little bit more because, you know, and then all of the tensions around vaccines and people's, you know, beliefs about that came into play, and different rules and, you know, changing sort of goalposts on what was allowed and what wasn't. And
I've never seen so many people become very intense about some aspect of what was going on, and now they're all kind of coming down to earth again. Instead of being, you know, flying high and being full of beans, they're sort of talking more like normal people once again. It's kind of refreshing in a way to get back.
And interestingly, you know, COVID was definitely an issue, but at the same time we had climate things going on, so there was that sort of double whammy of, you know, fires and smoke and hot temperatures and landslides and floods and sort of, wow, this is almost, you know, biblical.
And that part has only got more prominent, especially lately down south of the border and a few other places. It's really having a huge impact on everybody's life, and we're going to have to deal with it. But for now, we're going to deal with permaculture, by golly.
Yes.
What it is, where it comes from, all that kind of stuff. Now, I did a little homework. Course.
Okay, good. Of course you did.
So the concept's got ancient roots, and I'm really interested that that's come to the fore. The name may be new, but the processes go back many thousands of years. Its origin in Indigenous cultures around the world. And it's come into the capitalist extractivist world that we, the settlers, have developed here in the last century. And in a certain way, it's a repudiation of the motivations that have animated this kind of world we've created, because it puts natural values and processes first in our relationship to food sources and landscapes. Now, Bill Mollison, anybody who's read anything on permaculture knows his name. He's an Australian academic. They call him the father of permaculture. And he was inspired by the indigenous practice, the ancient indigenous practices in Tasmania, worked at the University of Tasmania. And one of the things he said was this. He said, permaculture is a philosophy of working with rather than against nature, of protracted and thoughtful observation rather than protracted and thoughtless labor, and of looking at plants and animals and all their functions rather than treating any single area as a single product system. So why don't you interpret that from your point of view and what that feels like to you?
Yeah, I definitely credit goes to Indigenous cultures around the world for this. And I would say not specifically women, you know, women are very naturally connected to the land and the waters, natural water protectors. So certainly, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude for that knowledge. And it's something that is ongoing in terms of figuring out what happened when settlers arrived in the New World, you know, this sort of challenging situations of the new land and trying to survive and thinking that, you know, sort of conventional agricultural methods were going to work in this place. And obviously we've found over the last 150 years that you can really mess things up really
we're
quickly.
We're quite good at messing things up sometimes. Oh my goodness gracious.
But also that, you know, that those ideas and concepts and strategies were magically, amazingly kept alive and thankfully shared. And so what it really, for me, you know, after experiencing some natural disasters throughout my life, what permaculture gave to me when I got certified in 2014 was a real tool belt of tools that I could use to help that, you know, feeling proactive and solutions based with some of the things instead of feeling like, you know, oh, the sky's falling and there's nothing we can do.
And all the teaching about permaculture starts with the land and then says care for the people. And it also includes people. There's this mm-hmm. idea, this sort of romantic notion in Western culture, industrial culture, that you take all the people out and everything will be fine. But in fact, the people, our ancestors, we're really good at enhancing and working with and facilitating the process of nature. There's also an implicit thing that I read when I'm reading about permaculture, about limiting consumption. You don't just mm-hmm. go to this nth degree of extracting everything you can out of the ecosystem.
Right. Actually, yeah, you know, it's sort of the law of thirds, you know, and that's... Yeah. You know, three comes up a lot, you know, yes. This sort of care for earth, care for people and fair share, or some people call that return the surplus. So, for example, let's say we're talking about a berry bush, you know, instead of stripping that berry bush completely of berries when it's time, that we would only harvest a third, we would leave a third for habitat for other animals, and then a third for reseeding for next year so that the plant can regenerate itself. So
that's such a nice concept. That's such a resonant, beautiful concept that we don't ever take all of what's on our plate. Mm-hmm. We live a little bit for the other life forms and for the forces of nature that provide us with all this stuff. Now, yeah. And I think more and more, as you say, Indigenous knowledge and Western science are kind of coming together, with the latter, the Western science, recognizing that in many ways it's subservient to this Indigenous perspective, which can tell us what to do next, as it were, you know, where to go. Now, I should, you mentioned about the fact that you got your permaculture certificate in 2014, but a little before that, I'm going to throw out some names, and you're going to tell me exactly what they meant.
Okay.
Garbage Warrior film.
Oh yeah. You know, I worked in the film industry in Vancouver before coming out to the Okanagan, and was getting quite into documentaries, and I've always loved documentaries. Mm. I'm, you know, a bit of a nerd. Like information.
You were ahead of your time. They're now they have whole festivals, you know, documentary mm-hmm. festivals. Yeah.
So I saw this film, Garbage Warrior, about this sort of wild architect, Mike Reynolds, down in Taos, New Mexico, that was doing these radically sustainable buildings, integrating...
Earthships,
exactly. So integrating sort of waste products into home building, integrating the outdoors, indoors. And I just, you know, it just, a light went off. I just found it really inspiring. He was very rogue and quite an interesting character. And so within that, sort of a subtopic that came up in the film was, well, hey, if you're going to have these houses that include greenhouses, you're going to have to know how to grow food. You're going to have to know about the water cycle. You're going to have to know about composting and, waste reduction. So, I was fortunate enough that Mike Reynolds was going to Seattle in 2014, 13, 20, one of those years.
Yes.
And he was doing a conference down in Seattle. So I went down with a friend and heard there was a 1 hour sort of sub talk about permaculture. And whatever that woman said during that hour, really, I was like, wow, this is what I need in my life. This is sort of wraps it all up. And it's not just about growing food and water. It's about how we live our lives. How do we reconnect to the land?
That's right. It's
And
very.
when you're in the city, you really it's difficult. There's not a lot of opportunities for that. You can't see the stars. You don't really have access to land. You might have a little garden box, but you can't.
But you met the big Seattle food forest.
I did not. There's the Beacon Food Forest in Seattle. I wasn't able to make it out to that, unfortunately. I would love to, but it's definitely,
It
seeing it
was in the
online and whatnot.
atmosphere. There was a food forest floating around on high.
Yeah. And then, I got back to Vernon, and again, just fortuitously, at the time, Gord Hebert and Jana McNabb had a company called Element Eco Design, and they were offering a PDC or a permaculture design course, a certification course. And so did that, and quite frankly, got off on a sidetrack of compost for a number of years.
That's an
But
okay sidetrack to be on.
yeah, no, it was good. It's good. And we thankfully a lot of the awareness has been raised now and people understand the importance of it. And then, yeah, 2021, it was interestingly, the year I started, I was evacuated from my home from a wildfire. We had the heat dome happen that year. And I thought, wow, this is interesting timing to be starting a land-based business and to be, trying to make things better because things are
Not better.
seemingly getting worse and it's becoming
Yes.
more challenging. So it is more important than ever, I believe.
I'll just remind listeners once again that I'm talking to Kelly Westgate, the owner of Lecker Land Design. We're certainly very aware of climate impacts on just about everything we do now, and it's about time. I think Mother Earth has been sending us messages for quite some time with us saying, yeah, thank you very much, but we're busy. Now she's saying, well, I'm going to get up your nose a little bit, boys and girls, and then we'll see what happens next. Now, when we were talking before the show, I was kind of overwhelmed by your description of this massive project in the north sort of end of Vernon on what are called the BX lands. That's a very new name. There's fortunately a more appropriate indigenous name for at least part of what's happening. Sinchiche Mahuchin is the. I sound so brilliant. It's a phonetic spelling of the name. When I looked at the
It's
letters,
difficult
I
pronunciation.
looked at the letters and it just it. As I said, I'll never be able to do this. And then you so helpfully sent me the phonetic version
The
of it.
audio file, yeah.
Yeah, this the official settler name for this is the BX Ranchlands Development Plan. And truly, it is a transformational project. And it's a transformational project as it brings us back to the roots that of our human, forerunners who lived in this area, who had so much knowledge that we, for a century or two, just walked right past and either ignored or actually actively tried to eliminate. Now, it's a total area of 167 acres, but I don't think we could start talking about it until there's a little background showing what a transformational and a certain disruptive project it is, because there was disruption that settlers brought. And on the website on about this project, it says, the area was an important site for indigenous hunting and gathering. However, these activities were greatly disrupted by the implementation of settler agricultural practices in the 1870s. Settlers used the land to provide pastures for the horses of the BX Express stagecoach. I didn't know where that name came from, and now I do, which moved people, goods, and communications throughout the province. In recent years, It has been primarily used for growing forage and hay crops and overwintering horses and cattle. Now, that's what was done by us guys, us folks, the people mm-hmm. who landed in this area very recently. But in a way, this whole project is a kind of a tacit admission of a fatal flaw in Western industrial approaches and a correction. And that's why the name Sinchichihukmahinhukin is such an important thing. It's showing what went before. So it's very multi-dimensional. It was originally private land, and then the municipality bought it, as I understand, which is a pretty forward-looking thing because it's a big area. So why don't you talk about some of the elements in this project? Because you laid them out, and it was every time you added another layer, I thought, oh my goodness, this is
can
just...
this be real?
Well, it is. It's such a progressive idea, you know, and a big one too.
It is. It's very ambitious. It's very inspiring. You know, the public is probably just starting to hear about it now. Yeah. But honestly, yeah, it's been a long road. It's been, you know, years and years in the making to where we are now, and there's still plenty of work to do.
Yes, indeed.
But yeah, the land was going to be sold off, and due to public pressure and interest and petitions and feedback, it was purchased by the regional district of the North Okanagan, and it is kept now in public hands. So very grateful for those people that stood up and, you know, made their voices heard for that. It's such an important piece of property. And so, you know, once that was done in 2021, 2022, an advisory committee was formed and sort of a development study project done by Kwantlen Polytechnic University in the regional district with help from the Land to Table Network,
yes.
Which at the time was called the North Okanagan Food Systems Initiative.
Hmm.
And so I was on the original steering committee of NOFSI at the time. And then we spent probably about 6 months, about 20 of us from various, you know, realms of agriculture, had these meetings and came up with this development plan that is very ambitious. But it, you know, what was pleasantly surprising was it really seemed like everybody was on the same page. You know, when it came out, it was like, we all want this to be, you know, organic, we want it to be biodiverse, we want a place where innovation happens, where education happens, you know, that is regenerative, that is, you know.
Did you have a sense in this, which, by the way, this kind of six-month conversation is very much what Bill Mollison was saying about protracted and thoughtful observation. Mm-hmm. And of course, you were observing each other and you were observing your ideas and your thoughts and your feelings about this. Did you, as this process was proceeding, did you have a sense that you were kind of charting a pathway back to where we needed to get? That you were really pushing the needle back towards where it needed to be, centered in the processes that would save us as a civilization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think everybody on the committee understands deeply how fragile our food system is and how important it is to get people back to the land. You know, this kind of connects to a webinar that I did last year with the Shuswap Climate Action Group and partnered with the Okanagan Xeriscape Association. It was called Lose the Lawn. And, you know, within that, we were talking about, okay, well, we're, you know, in a drought situation and we need to cut down on our water use and whatnot. How do we do that? And one of the interesting points, you know, that I brought forward in that was that, you know, why do we have lawns? Where did that come from? Why do we think that that is the way?
It is
and
a bit really insane
a
when you look into it.
Colonial hangover.
Yeah.
It's really a wealthy European, you know, we don't need to grow food. We just, you know, have this big lawn that, you know, isn't productive. But now we are, you know, our hand is being forced. We have to look at things differently. And
indeed.
And really the year that I started my business, 2021, was the point of no return. I mean, that year was really, like you said, you know, Mother Earth just slapping us in the face multiple times from multiple angles.
Yes, wake up, boys
going,
and girls.
Come on. Okay, if you didn't get it when I sent the heat dome, well, here's some fires. Okay, now here's, you know, a atmospheric river, and then here's landslides, and we saw the grocery store shelves go empty. So this is really born of necessity, and I think all of us that are involved really understand that we need to just really seriously focus on local food security.
And the report from Kwantlen was kind of a summary of some of the issues that needed to be dealt with, called the future of BC's food systems. And we're going to, but it was, of course, only a catalyst. The process that you went through was really, really important. The Swan Lake Community Association also played a central role in this.
Absolutely.
Paul Jeffrey Williamson, I saw a few comments by him online. Well, what were the elements that you felt had to be in this new project? Obviously, there are some very important parts. There's a trail.
Yeah.
There's land to grow food, of course. There's a park. Will there be a food forest in this project?
Of course there will be.
Oh, my goodness. I just sort of intuitively knew that.
Yes, right. We hadn't discussed it before.
No.
Yes, and that will be the first thing, actually, that's looking at being developed on the site. So we're working on that right now, just doing some community engagement and outreach and an initial design plan so that some of the user groups and nonprofits involved can start applying for grants for tree planting and events and whatnot. I think one of the most important things for me, and I think many others would agree, is that the agricultural industry, as well as the horticultural industry, needs educational spaces that are specific to the interior region, because so much of the education that exists right now is Vancouver-based or, you know, Calgary-based,
right.
And we have a unique ecosystem here.
We do.
and it's challenging. And so really starting to integrate more indigenous plants, locally adapted plants, you know, and changing our palates, starting to eat more seasonally, but having a place where people can go to learn some of these things and do some experimentation, try out some innovative methods. So I know through Vernon Permaculture, which is a group I facilitate at the library each month.
12 years.
It's 12 years it's been, yeah, I haven't personally run it for 12 years, but it's been alive. Yeah.
Wonderful.
So we have this great community of people that get together and we just, you know, that's the sort of return the surplus part of it. It's, you know, I run it on a volunteer basis and bring in speakers and we're doing plant shares and seed shares and now the group really wanted to get their hands dirty and be able to, you know, get involved on a deeper level, not just sit around and chat, of course. And so this site holds a lot of opportunity for that. There's going to be, you know, a pollinator meadow. There's going to be, you know, portions of an acre that you can lease for trying out your own farming. There's
every time you add another layer, I sort of giggle inside. It just seems so. It's to me, and I wonder if this phrase would apply. From your perspective, a course correction. It's a course correction. It's like, oh, we were heading towards the iceberg. Let's redirect our energies.
Yeah. And it's complicated. I'm not going to say it's easy because it's something that, as you know, as far as we know, hasn't been done out here. And there are agricultural parks, you know, in other places. Mm. But, you know, even myself, I try to increase my education every year. And, you know, last year I did a Living Green Infrastructure course and the prior year I did climate change adaptation fundamentals, and which are great, but again, very focused on Vancouver area or the island where, you know, they have different challenges than we have.
They have
here.
Radically different challenges. I mean, as soon as you drive up the Coquihalla, it's raining in Vancouver, it's drizzling in Hope, and then halfway up the Coquihalla, it's starting to dry out. The clouds are dissipating, and you can feel the air drying out as you move along. It's clear that you're going into a whole different bioregion.
And water is key. Yeah, water is definitely a huge challenge.
Very, very, very much so. I'm trying to put into words what I feel about this from what you've told me, which is that it's an acceptance of the fact that people have been altering, we humans have been altering landscapes for thousands of years. And but we did it in the past in congruence with natural processes. Then we kind of took off, the colonial era was a taking off into just grabbing and running and making things that we wanted and ignoring natural processes. J.B. McKinnon, the guy who wrote 100 Mile Diet with his wife, He's written another book called The Once and Future World, and he talks about how much indigenous communities altered. He said at one point, the grassland that I was raised on was not a grassland naturally. It was a grassland created by indigenous people saying, well, the buffalo will like it better if we make more grass. And so let's make some more grass. And that's exactly what was done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It looked like it was, you know, wild land, but it was cultivated, and it's too bad. It's really, really a shame. And the more you learn about what was lost, it really is devastating.
Now, the role of Lecker Landscape Design is to do the outreach, to act as a sort of a link between the community and the project. What sort of things what kind of work are you doing in that respect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I love about permaculture is the diversity of my work, because, you know, I think it's easy for people to think, well, she's a landscaper, she does edible landscaping, but there's so much more to it than that. And I really value that in my work. So sometimes it is community engagement. Last year I did a clean energy home retrofit project, community engagement. This year, you know, I'm still working on the Lighthouse Food Forest in Salmon Arm at the Salvation Army. I'm doing private consultations for homeowners who realize they want to get rid of their lawn and have something more productive. Installations, education, you know, seminars. So it's great, because there definitely is a growing interest in, you know, okay, we do have to do something here. Like, I'm noticing changes. So, and there has to be somebody that offers that service. And it is difficult, because, you know, you brought up a good point earlier about sort of capitalism, and, you know, permaculture does butt heads with capitalism, because, you know, if I could just do my work for free and, you know, and somehow magically, you know, money just appeared in my bank account every month, that would be wonderful. But that's not the world we live in. And so that's definitely something that anybody who's a permaculture practitioner would probably agree, is that, you know, we want to give it all away for free, and it should be shared, absolutely. But how do we, you know, live in the modern world?
Yeah, that's right. Just remind listeners once again that I'm talking with Kelly Westgate, who is the owner of Lecker Land Design. Now, when you first heard about this project and then started to be involved in the group discussion that led up to its sort of concrete manifestation, what did the process feel like? Because you were meeting a lot of people. I mean, you knew many of them already, but you were meeting people who you discovered were sharing much of what you thought as well. You were sort of, instead of being off to the side, you were kind of in a project that was really very central to the community in the local area. It was involving all these nonprofit organizations, the Land Stable Network, you've mentioned already, the Swan Lake Community Association, Kwantlen University. So you had university involvement, which means you have, you know, the declared academics being involved. Mm-hmm. What was that like? It sounds like a revolution back to where we once were. Remember the university would have extension facilities. They'd send their academics out into the fields to sit with the farmer and with the grower. Did you get that feeling that we're kind of rebuilding something? This is...
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the early days when Land to Table was still called the North Okanagan Food Systems Initiative, and we held some panels and discussions at Okanagan College. And, you know, one of the key things in there was that, you know, when you're a farmer, you're out on the land, you're busy, your days are very full. By the time fall comes, you're exhausted, you know, you fall into bed, just want to hibernate for a couple months, but then you got to get back to it and figure out your seeding plan and all that. And so, for me, I would say the standout part was the communication, is being able to have access to people in all parts of the food system, and having those conversations, having that share, knowledge share of, and, you know, quite often it's, well, I don't have time to market, or I don't have, you know, I'm in the farmer's market for a full day and then I lose something. And then, you know, it's really hard to make a living these days as a farmer. Land has gotten quite expensive. you know, less and less people are farming. And so it is crucial that everybody within the system, from, you know, producers to processors to consumers, understand the importance of supporting local. I mean, we, again, back to 2021, we really saw that. What if the roads get cut? I mean, we never thought, how can that happen? You know, we can't have the roads cut off. And then all of a sudden, landslides took out numerous highways, not just one. So apparently we need that kind of a shock to really, you know, move things. But yeah, having the conversations, creating those connections, I really do credit Liz Blakeway from the Land to Table Network. It's not easy work. It's very complicated, and we always want more people involved. People can't be passive about their food anymore. You really need to get, you know, educated and, and know. And there's other groups involved as well, for the Shintamakakwan Agricultural Park. And I apologize to all Insilchin people.
I don't know, you got it off pretty quickly.
I've been trying to practice Shintamakakwan. The closest I'm getting right now. But the agricultural park, you know, it also includes the Ribbons of Green Society. It also includes the Okanagan Indian Band, the Allen Brooks Nature Center, the North Okanagan Naturalists. So it's really, all of these groups are now having the opportunity as well to interact with each other for a shared vision. And that's what I'm really excited about, is the development plan that came out really is a shared vision. And it was nice to be, you know, in the room, so to speak, virtually with all of these people that get it and that are working towards making things better.
So during this 6 month discussion period, did you sense a change in sort of atmosphere, kind of, as people got used to each other, they got used to discussing what was being planned and working out some of the details in process? It's always a process. It's never, you know, like, okay, we're going to do this. It's what did you sense any change in atmosphere from sort of the beginning to the end of that process, as there was an integration, kind of an integration of the vision?
You know, I think the underlying, for lack of a better word, vibe of people was this sense of urgency, that we all understand that this needs to happen as quickly as possible, but trying to make that work within a government system, within, you know, sort of different levels of bureaucracy and whatnot. So it's a balance, you know, it's understanding that, yes, we need to work quickly, but we also want to do it right. And which is more important? Well, they're both important. Mm-hmm. So that's an ongoing challenge, I would say. You know, people are, because we've been talking about this for years, and now here we are in 2025, you know, that steering committee was 3 years ago already. So, you know, everybody's chomping at the bit to get on that land and really start planting, you know, sharing, getting together, because we were so isolated for those couple years. And I think we all learned some things about that, is that we need each other. We need community. We're not going to figure this out alone.
Yeah, that notion of community is, I think, central to many of these kinds of projects. You have to do it as a group. You can't just do it on your own. Yeah. The other aspect of it that is obviously prominent is inspiration from Indigenous concepts and ideas, the old concept, the ancient ones, the ones that have been around since humans have been on the planet. Now, one of the people who you've said on several occasions was really inspirational for you was Marielle Bélanger, or I don't know if she pronounced it the French way, but I would.
Bélanger, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear it, because that's the way I'd pronounce it too, from Sioux Nation. What you learned from her, you've said several times that she was an important kind of inspiring person for you to get connected with. Can you see the spirit that she brought to your conversations alive in this project? I don't know if she's directly involved, but this kind of learning about how things can be done and have been done for very long periods of time plays into this project, because it seems to be inspired by Indigenous perspectives, or at least people are catching up to them now.
Yeah, the food forest portion, absolutely. You know, because that is really different from conventional agriculture, obviously. It's not straight lines, you know, based on tractor tires. And so that will, I think, take some getting used to for people, is that it doesn't look like agriculture, even though it is. And yeah, Mariel and I have had a lot of discussions about reconciliation and what that looks like. And it's difficult. It's not easy. It's uncomfortable for a lot of people. There's no easy answers. There's no guidebook. So, you know, we're all sort of stumbling through and figuring it out the best we can, probably making mistakes along the way. But you know, I think the spirit of, hey, we got to start somewhere and we've got to try. And hopefully, you know, if we can take a couple steps forward, somebody else can maybe learn from that experience and build upon it. That's really the hope.
Yes. Gives you a sense of the timeline is not one's individual lifetime. It is multiple lifetimes. The notion of seven generations, mm-hmm, preparing, mm-hmm, for the next seven generations. Now, you kind of touched on a couple of issues. One is the role of women and, mm-hmm, how prominent it is. And this has come up on a number of with a number of guests on the show, how women have taken the lead and how women's perspective and just sort of easy understanding of certain things has really facilitated a lot of processes that are going forward right now. People like Suzanne Simard, for example, who, mm-hmm, when she started out doing her work with forest ecosystems and fungal networks, subterranean fungal networks, was kind of marginalized. But now she's a professor at UBC and she's, mm-hmm, she's, you know, renowned throughout the world, basically. Do you sense that change? As a woman who's running a business that's, you know, very enmeshed in the economy, but also very enmeshed in bringing ideas into the economy that are not the standard settler, you know, formula. How does that feel for you and what you see around you?
Mm-hmm. Good question. a lot to unpack there. I would say there's so many women doing great work. You know, right now I'm reading Medicine Wheel for the Planet by Dr. Jennifer Grenz.
Who's, so am I, as a matter of fact.
Oh, are you?
Yes,
oh,
I am.
And what a great perspective to have, because, you know, she was educated in the sort of, you know, university system, but also is an Indigenous woman. And so, yes, bringing that perspective to things and really being honest and raw about, you know, internally this battle that's happening,
yes,
of, you know, what I know from my culture versus what I've been told. And, you know, Robin Wall Kimmerer, the Braiding, yes, Sweetgrass book, beautiful love letter to the earth.
Yeah.
And so many other women, Dr. Jeanette Armstrong, local here, people who are doing great work. And I would say up to now, and hopefully that's changing, it hasn't been appreciated enough. And sort of, I think maybe there's been a perception that, you know, gardening, it's just like a hobby that the ladies, yeah, do for exercise and well-being or whatever, but it's not, it's earth care. It is, yeah, it is. Women do seem to have that natural connection. Maybe it's because, you know, the cycles of the moon and we can't, mm-hmm, help ourselves. and so I think the important thing for me to share with listeners is that this is the important work. And I would say, I just want to put out a, you know, advocate for women in this sense that quite often it's unpaid work. And it needs to be paid. This is the most important thing. We all need food every single day, multiple times a day. And so we need to really invest in this.
And we're seeing
in the women involved.
And we're seeing examples of people, mostly men, who are paid way too much. And a very huge number of people, many of them women, probably more women than men, who are paid too little, who do, mm-hmm, work that is essential and transformative in its impact, but which is just simply not recognized. It also shows that paying people money doesn't have any real relationship to the value of what they're doing, that some people can do things that are profoundly valuable for which they get no remuneration. raising children, you know.
Yeah, and I would say in this realm, there historically has been sort of an expectation that volunteers would come forward and do this work. And with the economy the way that it is right now, what many nonprofits that I work with are finding is people don't have either the capacity or the energy or the ability to give free labor anymore.
You've just given me a perfect entree. This is unplanned, wonderful serendipity.
Segue.
into the notion of universal basic income, which is sort of a reflection of how indigenous communities were structured. If somebody brought, had caught a lot of salmon or harvest, captured or killed a deer, it would be brought to the community and everybody would be given a share. And it wasn't based on your role in the community. It was based on the fact that you were in the community. And this kind of notion, you don't have to, that everybody's role is valuable.
Right.
Everybody's role is valuable.
Sorry. I was going to say what that brings up for me when I hear you say that is the work at the Lighthouse Community Food Forest in Salmon Arm there at the Salvation Army, because that's a great microcosm of this conversation, because it is a free food place. You know, obviously people can get stuff from the market there that's been donated, but quite often, obviously, that's a lot of processed food. It's maybe not the healthiest food that gets donated. And so to be able to transform that front lawn, unproductive dead grass, into an abundant hybrid food forest, you know, it does have annuals and perennials as well.
Sure.
But to have that access and that visibility for people to see food growing and to be able to pull a carrot or pluck a cucumber or, you know, have a fresh strawberry. I mean, there's nothing like that. It's nothing like what you get in the grocery store. You know, it's alive. It was just picked. That can be a real light bulb for people, and also an invitation to get involved. You know, some days that I'm there, you know, maybe somebody hasn't registered to volunteer per se, but they happen to be walking by and they come in and help me turn the compost or, you know, help me harvest something or just want to have a conversation and share what their grandma used to do. And so beyond the food aspect of it, it's the community building, it's the education. And so those links are crucial. And we don't always know how much food is being harvested from that site. And, you know, you want to know, you want to quantify.
Have the number.
You want to weigh it and know how many pounds. And we don't always know. But anecdotally, we do know from people that drop by and chat, say, oh, yeah, I came by and grabbed this, or I made a pie from that, or I clipped some herbs. And it's just really heartwarming.
I'd just like to remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Kelly Westgate, the owner of Lecker Land Design. The Food Forest Project in Salmon Arm at the Salvation Army site, and other similar projects in Vernon that you've worked on and been part of the development of, have kind of brought to the fore some of the tensions within our community, the tensions that arise from inequity. I remember a long time ago you told me that one of your passions was social justice. And I think it's becoming a more widespread passion all the time, I'm pleased to see. But the notion that some have a lot and some have very little creates inevitable pressures and sometimes misbehaviors and difficulty in stopping oneself from doing something that, you know, might at the first pass appear to be destructive, but really is just an attempt to get what is very hard to get for some people in our community. Mm-hmm. People who are disabled, people who have addiction problems, people who have grown up in families that are fragmented and full of trauma. And they often end up in situations where they're marginalized and taken out of the mainstream. And a place like a food forest is sort of a place where you can go and feel maybe some calm energy that you don't find on a blacktop city street, or a place where people are, you know, giving you handouts. You can take a handout off a tree, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you just comment generally about this? This is again, exposing a problem that we have in our society, that we have people who are have so little, and we have other people who have so much. And there are people working hard, like the Salvation Army, to try and bridge that gap. But mm-hmm. it can't be bridged until we really change some basic fundamental ways we structure our world.
Yeah, you know, definitely so much more compassion is needed. You know, everybody's fighting a battle that we don't know. And as you said, the trauma is deep in our communities, and it comes from many areas. And so while I'm not, you know, a counselor or a therapist, I have personally found that food is not necessarily neutral territory, but it is universal in that we all need it every day.
Yes.
And so,
as I say to my patients, you're addicted to food, but we'll deal with it.
Exactly. And, you know, we do run into some challenges on that site. It is somewhat, you know, kind of experimental and revolutionary and hopeful and all of these things, but it is also, you know, there's no locked fence or gate around it or anything like that. So yeah, I wish I could say it's all sunshine and roses, but there's challenges. So sometimes we experience vandalism. Sometimes we've got people who are having, you know, mental health, issues publicly. Yeah. And that can be scary for the community. But I think what the other side of that is that, as I said, you know, when we spoke yesterday, sometimes people just walk by and offer a hand for a few minutes.
Yes,
and
right.
even if you don't feel like you, quote unquote, have much to offer, you do. You might have 5 minutes of labor to offer, or you might have, you know, a story to share that inspires somebody, or you know, I've seen somebody come by and clip off the top of a sunflower to give to their friend. And I think, well, you know what? There's just somebody trying to be kind.
Yes.
And then that should be recognized, because that's going to bring joy to somebody. And that's going to be a ripple effect of, you know, wow, somebody gave me a flower today, or I tasted that beautiful strawberry, or, you know, just even wandering through the site, having the sense that somebody is doing this work for me, even though I'm, you know, struggling right now.
Yeah,
and even if it's not realized, it is internalized, and one, you know, it sinks in.
Cultures where income distribution is more even, there's lots of research showing that they are healthy cultures in every respect. When you give everybody enough, then the incentive to veer off the path into antisocial mm-hmm. behavior is removed,
and
all sorts of constructive things come out of that. I think the reason to talk about this is because it's a real issue, first of all, and the solutions require all of us sort of pulling together. We have to change the way the system works, not expect individuals who are on the short end of the stick to pull themselves together and fly right. We have to all be part of helping them do that. Let's talk a little bit about some of your other projects, because I love the notion of rainwater harvesting and conservation in an area, as you said earlier, where water is a big issue. Why not grab a few raindrops and hang on to them and use them when you need them? When you what sort of stuff are you doing there?
Well, you know, plants love rainwater. Quite often we're chlorinating water that goes out onto our gardens.
How naughty of us.
Prefer that. No, yes, plants prefer the rainwater. You know, being that we are in a multi-year drought and we've had the driest, hottest year on record in 2024, after taking the Living Green Infrastructure course last year, I sort of spun off into getting certified in rainwater harvesting systems. And that was through the American Rainwater Catchment Association. Because we don't get a lot of rain, and all of the climate predictions that we've seen, you know, the Pacific Climate Institute sort of projections for what's happening, is that when we do get precipitation in the future, it'll be, you know, sort of short, fast bursts. And what happens to the soil when you haven't had rain for a long time, it becomes what's called hydrophobic. So it just hits and runs off the top.
So it's fearful of water. That's what it means.
Yes, and the best place to store water is actually in the soil. So we need to sort of create that receptacle or that sponge that the water can hit. So that's why we're, you know, putting really thick mulch on the ground and whatnot. And so, you know, you can passively collect the water or you can actively collect the water. So the active would be sort of your cisterns and barrels and whatnot. And the passive is, you know, getting the water to stretch across your landscape and slowly meander around it instead of, you know, getting it, you know, which is so interesting to me that we created all of this infrastructure around, you know, getting the water away and channeling it away from our properties. And now, now the logic has changed to, you know, try to keep that water on your property and use it as many times as you can before it hits the stormwater system.
Yes, so, just even such a thing as having a ditch beside a road rather than a curb means that the water runs off the road into a ditch and sits there, as opposed to sitting in a curb, running down the road to the nearest grid drain, and then being flushed out into the lake, as opposed to staying on the land. It's those kinds of processes and changes are starting to filter into municipal planning systems and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, water is another one of those areas, as well as the food system, that I would love to see people really dig into, because again, we need water every day. It's crucial to life. We're dead without it. So, you know, I also joined the Society for the Protection of Kalamalka Lake this year in my commitment to protecting the water, because we've seen more algae blooms, we've seen E. coli, we've seen floods and droughts and all of these things affecting the water system. So really, like, I just really want to bring forward for people that every single one of you that gets involved in any of these things is making a difference. Every person matters. All of your input is useful. So I just want to speak on behalf of a lot of the nonprofits I work for. We need volunteers. We need people involved. And I know that the world can seem like a scary place and you don't know where to start and you feel helpless, and just, you know, find an organization that's doing something that interests you and get involved, because there's so many ways to do it. And on the Food Forest site, for example, as well as the agricultural park out here in Vernon, weeding is, we will always need people to help weed. We will always need people to help water. So that's a really easy thing. Even if you can donate an hour to just pluck some weeds, it is important, you know, so get involved. Yeah.
My term for weeds is hardy native perennials.
Yes. Oh, well, in permaculture, we would call them either volunteers.
but you know, it's, we have this kind of idea that, again, our indigenous forerunners didn't alter the landscape, you know, to shape it to serve their purposes, but in fact, of course, they did things like cutting down forests so that you could have more grassland.
Cultural burns, yeah, exactly. Doing cultural burns, yeah, planting, spreading seed. You know, as you walk along and gather seeds, you're spreading seeds and you're constantly giving back to the land. And really, that reciprocal relationship with the land is so crucial. So that's the other thing I would say, is just get outside more in 2025. You know, really try to build that relationship with the land, however that looks for you.
We're getting close to the end of the show. One of the things that I wanted to get a bit of an idea, an orientation about, is your teaching activities and what you find when you bring forward a course and when you offer it. Are you sensing that the community is starting to realize that some of the stuff you're talking about is really important or really valuable or really interesting or really fun?
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, the media landscape is certainly changing by the day, and social media is getting more challenging. And obviously, you know, the truth is a moving target these days. So, but yeah, I think that, as I said, that one Lose the Lawn seminar with the ShoeSwap Climate Action last year was one of their most highly attended webinars, with over 350 people registering,
which was,
you know, kind of shocking, but it really told us that there is a you know, seismic shift happening in people's minds, because they can't ignore this anymore. And there's a healing that happens when you start getting involved in this too. Like, even if you just have a little planter and you, you know, throw some lettuce seeds in there, that's a start. And then, you know, it's an addiction, but it's a good one.
Every kid who sees a seed going to the ground and then sees something coming out later that's come from that seed I remember doing that as a kid, and I don't, you never forget it. You never forget
and
it.
And schools, yeah, and schools will be integral. We really want school involvement and, you know, having little mini farms on schools and getting kids engaged really early.
Kelly, it's been a delight to have you back on the show. I remember meeting you when you were running as a Green Party candidate, and because no one else was prepared to do it, and you said, oh, well, I'll put my effort in. But I think now you're really getting, as you say, getting your hands dirty. You're getting yourself directly involved with some really important work that is going to change what we do and how we think and how we live on this planet. Thank you so much for joining us
today.
And
thank you for your work too, Warren. Like, I just love what you're doing there. And thank you, AskYous, for sponsoring this.
Thank you so much, Kelly. Take care.
Bye now.